Thought Leader Thursdays are sponsored by Associated Bank. Whether you're buying, building, or refinancing a home, Associated Bank is dedicated to finding the right mortgage solution for you. Visit associatedbank.com/thoughtleadership. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Run with David Fowler, Senior Vice President of Capital Markets at Associated Bank. David, welcome back.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. I hope you are, too. David's here today to help those of us who are international investors, bringing his expertise in European markets, especially the UK. And David, Brexit is once again front and center today. British lawmakers voting on changes to trade rules for Northern Ireland. What's going on there?
Well, yes. You know, what we've just seen in the last 24 hours is the UK Parliament has passed what's been called the Windsor Framework. And this was a deal that was done between the UK and the European Union to revise some of the terms and conditions of the Northern Ireland Protocol, which we've talked about multiple times. And really, the idea behind this kind of change in the treaty was to allow trade between the UK and Northern Ireland to have a simpler route into Northern Ireland and from Northern Ireland into the UK. And this was facilitated by a change in technology that's used for customs and duties. And the UK is now, with this changed technology, they can give the European Union a sight into actual traffic, goods traffic between mainland GB into Northern Ireland and vice versa. By having this change, this technology change, this allowed the European Union then to make some changes from their side. So now, the a lot of the 70% of the kind of paperwork that was involved in moving something from Scotland to Northern Ireland, or from Northern Ireland to Scotland or England or Wales, has now been removed, and they've basically brought in a kind of like what you see at the airport. You know, there's a green channel if you have nothing to declare. And in this case, this is for goods that will stay within Northern Ireland or goods that will stay within the UK, depending on where they're coming from, and a red channel. So a red channel would be if you're a UK exporter going through Northern Ireland, you know, and these are goods that are going to go into the European Union. So if they go into the Irish Republic or somewhere else, then they go through the red channel and they are checked. But, you know, for 70% of the paperwork, and a huge percentage of the trade, there is now no paperwork involved at all. So this really opens up the UK Northern Ireland market as a kind of a single entity. But it also, to be honest, kind of reinforces this kind of situation that Northern Ireland has this unique status within Europe. And, you know, lots of times when we talk about Brexit, it's kind of a little bit like inside baseball, maybe for some people. It doesn't really apply that much to what's going on. But, you know, what I would say to companies that are looking to move to Europe, you know, you have a couple of things that are lining up really nicely now. One is the dollar is quite strong against all European currencies, the euro, sterling, Scandinavian, Swiss franc. It's very strong. So it makes inward investment from the U.S. into Europe relatively cheap from an exchange rate point of view. And you have an area in Northern Ireland that has unique access. It is unfettered access into the U.K. and it is unfettered access into the European Union. There is no other country in Europe that has this. So, you know, from a kind of an international locational standpoint for companies in the U.S. looking to go into Europe, Northern Ireland should be on their list because now they're a really interesting situation. And as an example, you know, Coca-Cola built an enormous syrup facility in Northern Ireland. They had one in the Irish Republic, and they basically moved it across the border. And this is there to allow Coke to export syrup throughout Europe. And the reason they put it in Northern Ireland was because of that access that Northern Ireland has to all the markets in Europe. So it's quite eventful. This is quite an important thing. And for, you know, U.S. companies looking to move to Europe, it's something they should kind of think about.
Yeah. And it sounds from your description like the floodgates have been lifted. And this must make people in Northern Ireland very happy.
Well, most of them anyway. Yeah. I think the unionists are still going to, the DUP is still, you know, saying that they're not going to go into the local parliament for the moment, but that may change too. But this is certainly a large step forward. And it's good. It's a good thing to see. Because one of the things that, you know, even industry in Northern Ireland were saying that, you know, whether they like the regulations or don't like the regulations, that's not as important as whether the regulations are going to be there for a while, because they want some kind of certainty. And businesses generally can adapt to whatever regulation comes down the pike once they know that's what it is. What they can't adapt to is this constant changing. And with this Windsor framework, Northern Ireland Protocol is pretty much done. There's no going to be no more changes to this. So now they know what the situation is, and then they can make their plans accordingly to operate within this accord.
If this can be done for the Northern Ireland trade situation with Brexit, the other problems that have been created by Brexit seemingly would be next on the list, right? Or is this just a one-off in terms of fixing some of Brexit's problems?
Well, this really was the kind of the, of all the problems that are with Brexit, and there are many, this was the most significant, both from, I think, an economic standpoint, but also from a symbolic standpoint. You know, the Conservative Party in particular, it's kind of in their name, it's the Unionist Party. They want to keep the union of the United Kingdom. The Northern Ireland Protocol and the after effects of what was going on was something that was pushing Northern Ireland to look at maybe moving to a United Ireland, Ireland, for example, as we've seen, like with Scotland trying to get independence. This, from a political point of view, I think for the Conservatives, I think this is really important. And the, you know, when it went to the vote in Parliament, you know, it was, they had nearly a 500 vote majority on this, so it was a very solid vote. Other problems, I think, are going to be a little more difficult. Some have been included in this. So, for example, in the, there's a scientific research part of the European, what did exist in the European Union called the Horizon Project. And this was where scientists from across the European Union worked on different aspects. So, for example, some of them were working on COVID vaccine creation and stuff like this. The UK is no longer part of that. It is hoped that as part of the framework, Britain can be brought back into this Horizon project. And if that's the case, it certainly would be good for British science. And, you know, one of the things that Britain is trying to be now is this kind of scientific beacon of innovation within Europe. Mm-hmm. How successful they will be, I'm not sure. But being outside of the Horizon project will make it much more difficult.
David, there are a couple of other things I want to hit on here while we have time that are happening in the UK and through the European Union as well. One of them, back still in Great Britain, is that the finance minister has dropped a plan to tax sovereign wealth funds who've been investing in Britain. We're talking about big wealth funds from places like the Middle East and others that have put a lot of money into British projects. Talk about how important this is.
Well, it's pretty important, and it kind of dovetails into what we just discussed. One of the, you know, harnessing the, you know, the power of Brexit, which is what the, you know, the Conservatives talk about a lot, one of the aspects is to try to reform how the industrial landscape in the UK lays out. And they are trying hard to become kind of like the Silicon Valley of Europe. And the people, the organizations that will fund that aspiration are organizations like sovereign wealth funds. So the anything that would be in place to discourage them from coming would seem to be a bad thing. And so it's not unusual that sovereign wealth funds can exist, that can invest without paying local tax. That's not unusual around the world. By bringing this in, it was something that was kind of looked at initially to generate revenue quickly, but I think on calm reflection, they realized this wouldn't be a great idea. So I think really this idea of using sovereign wealth funds to help fund a new industrial landscape, that was the prime motivator for dropping that idea.
There's been a lot of focus this week on interest rates, not only in the U.S., but around the world. The European Central Bank recently raised rates despite all of the situations with banks around the world. Talk to us a little bit about how this is impacting the European Union.
Well, in the European Union, it's, you know, one thing to kind of remember is that the European Central Bank, the ECB, has a different mandate to the Fed. So the Federal Reserve here has a dual mandate, which is price control and encouraging full employment. In the ECB, their mandate is the control of price. So they are hyper-focused on inflation. And, you know, when we, you know, we've seen them recently raise rates by about 0.5%, they're going to continue on the path to bringing inflation down. And this is for, you know, economic reasons, but it's also for cultural reasons. You know, Germany in particular was hammered by the hyperinflation of the Weimar Republic in the 1920s. And, you know, no one, like the Bundesbank, before the ECB, you know, when Germany had its own central bank, the Bundesbank, all they looked at was price stability. That's the only thing they looked at. And one of the reasons the ECB has that mandate is because of the influence of the Bundesbank and the German state within the European Union to create this similar idea. So I think we will see rates continue to climb higher. I think they will be done in a kind of very measured, broadcasted, step-by-step approach. Unless something really strange or unforeseen occurs, it's unlikely we're going to see any huge jump from meeting to meeting, but we will see this kind of 0.5%, maybe 0.25% progress up, you know, until we see, you know, interest rates in Europe probably topping out about 4.5, maybe 4.75, something like that.
Because this brings their mean rate now to 3%, so another 1.5% eventually.
They could, yeah.
Yeah.
Good.
Let's talk a little bit about China. Their growth came in a little lower, a little cooler than expected. Talk to us a little bit about how this puts China in the global picture, in the global markets picture.
Well, I think China is kind of an interesting kind of study because really what they're going through is the kind of maturity stage of economic development. So, you know, China's, you know, very old country. It's been going as a country. It's for a series of kingdoms. It's been going for, you know, thousands of years. But from a modern economic standpoint, really, you know, this kind of started really in the 1990s with this idea of becoming a place to attract inward investment. For a lot of reasons, and COVID, you know, and the impact on supply chain and all that kind of stuff is one, but not the only reason why companies are less interested to locate in China as, you know, inward investment than other places within Asia or other places, full stop. China is becoming, you know, has realizing that in order to continue this incredible economic growth that they've had, they have to fund some of this internally. And, you know, authorities announced a growth plan for the next year of 5%, which is quite, you know, for a lot of countries, they'd be quite happy with 5%. For China, that's very low. Historically. But really, it's based on this idea that now for the Chinese economy to continue to grow, it's got to grow internally. And what they have to try to do is the hardest thing will be to get people to spend internally because for years and years and years, Chinese people have, you know, saved, they're very active savers, they have a very high savings ratio. The government has to get people to start to lower that savings ratio in order to support it, domestic industries, whether it be industrial or consumption, and particularly in consumption. So I think China is going through the kind of growing stage that everybody else kind of goes through. It's just because it's, you know, it's a lot bigger than a lot of other countries. It becomes more pronounced. Obviously, there are other issues in play as well. So the ability, you know, there are other political issues. There are some other economic issues floating about. But really, the primary focus in China, I think, now is to try to build internally and to continue to develop this idea that this program they've had, which is the kind of the Belt and Road initiative, where they are looking to become the inward investors in other countries, in third countries, in places like Africa and places like South America, where they can come to partnerships, particularly with the non-aligned countries. So, you know, I think those are the two kind of roads that they will be following. But I think, you know, trying to unleash that internal market for consumption is what they're going to have to do. And if they're successful, you know, you have, you know, over a billion consumers, you know, that can generate an incredible economy.
the political issues that you talked about just briefly, global investors looking inward to China, concerned about Taiwan. They're also concerned about what they're going to do with Russia, right, and the ongoing invasion of Ukraine.
Yeah, there's a lot going on, you know, and I think the political issues are, you know, they're certainly important. I think there are other issues as well. We've talked about before this idea of kind of friendshoring or nearshoring or reshoring. This idea of, you know, the industrial location that was a great idea 30 years ago may not be such a great idea today. And that changes for a lot of reasons. Some of them, sometimes it's political, but a lot of times it's economic, with changes in technology, changes in production methods. You know, these things move around. And I think, you know, China will be seeing more and more of the, particularly the earlier entrants into the Chinese market from overseas, are starting to look at, you know, why don't we look at, you know, Cambodia? Why don't we look at Vietnam? Why don't we look at, you know, parts of South America? Why don't we look at parts of Africa? Because if we're trying to find that magic combination of location, labor, and luck, to a large extent, more appropriately legal, you know, they can find that in other places that might be an easier logistical hurdle than having so many eggs in one basket. Because, you know, during the pandemic, the issue that we saw day in, day out was that you could not get stuff out of Chinese ports to anywhere else because so much stuff was made in China that had to go through those ports before they could go anywhere else. If you had a better distribution of manufacturing across a number of countries, you know, that congestion aspect would go away.
David, I feel like I'm updated now and can take on the world. Thanks for all
there
that information.
News you can use.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. How can people get a hold of you and have a one-on-one if they want?
Sure. Well, you can always email me. And the my email address is david.feller. That's david.feller at associatedbank.com. Or you can always call our desk, which is 866-524-8836.
All right. David, we'll see you next time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bye, Steve.